All right, good evening, and welcome to the Spring 2015 Green Living Seminar Series at the Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts. Each spring semester, we invite a series of experts to campus to present on various aspects of sustainability. And I just want to point out that after this week, we'll be taking a break for a few weeks, and our next seminar will be on March 26th. This semester, our series topic is issues in climate change, and we have expert speakers on policy, advocacy, energy, nature conservation, and science, all with talks related to climate change. Tonight's speaker is Rob Sargent, the Energy Program Director at Environment America. Rob has more than two decades of experience leading a wide range of environmental and public interest campaigns. He currently oversees policy and strategy development for energy and global warming campaigns across the country. As policy advisor and strategist, he helps build citizen and stakeholder support to help win concrete policies to advance clean energy and limit climate-altering carbon pollution. Rob has authored and co-authored many reports on climate solutions, including The Way Forward on Global Warming, Reducing Carbon Pollution Today and Restoring Momentum for Tomorrow by Promoting Clean Energy, Lighting the Way, the top 10 states that helped drive America's solar energy boom in 2013, More Wind, Less Warming, How American Wind Energy's Rapid Growth Can Help Solve Global Warming. He is a 1982 graduate of the University of Vermont. Tonight's lecture will last about half an hour or so, and we'll have time for questions and dialogue after Rob's lecture. And his lecture tonight is entitled Building Support for the Shift to Clean Energy. Let's welcome Rob to MCLA.
Hi, everybody. Thanks for coming. For those of you that have come to a number of these, you've gotten a feel for, and I'm sure the fact that you're here indicates you have a little bit of an understanding of the challenge we face on climate. You know, we have a challenge that's scientific, which is the numbers don't lie. Carbon's building up in the atmosphere, and there's a point at which, well, we're already at a point where we can't avoid the consequences of climate-altering carbon in the atmosphere, but we have a reasonable chance, if we all lean into it and we do it right, to avoid the worst consequences of it through a shift to clean energy. And so that's hard enough, as it is, without there being things that stand in the way. Again, the fact that you're all here, probably you probably understand that there's been this polarization of this issue. I was talking to the students earlier, and I'm old enough to have experienced this still, is it used to be that the politics of clean energy was one that was more geographic in nature, and I like to call it used to be kind of apartisan. Not even bipartisan. I don't like that word because it makes it seem like whatever. But it was beyond politics. And then it was more geographic. So if you were from a coal state, you might not have been quite as interested in shifting away from coal. Or if you were from an oil state, you might not be as interested in shifting away from oil. But there wasn't an ideology around the idea of shifting to clean energy. It sort of transcended that. Now we still have that dynamic where whether you're a Republican or a Democrat and you're from a coal state or an oil state, you're going to tend to resist moving towards clean energy and limiting carbon. But then there's also become this kind of more rigorous partisan among elected officials. I would say with the public it's not quite as pronounced. And it's mostly driven by well-financed fossil interests that hopefully, if we do our job right, are on their last legs and doing whatever it takes to hold on to what they got. So that's the situation we're in, with unprecedented amounts of resources going into both confusing, blocking any significant progress in Congress and the ability to do that, and then also affecting the public discourse so that there's actually even a debate about whether carbon building up in the atmosphere is affecting our climate in this country. Nowhere else really is that debate happening. but here it is. So everything I just said, could lead us all to just be completely without hope. But I choose I choose to have hope, and here's why. There's incredible public support for solutions to the shift to clean energy, and it runs across the spectrum, the political spectrum, as long as you don't look at elected officials, but just across the spectrum with regular folks, and it runs across a variety of stakeholders, whether it be the business community, whether it be increasingly organized labor, and certainly a variety of other constituencies. And so whether it's on the question of shifting to clean energy and the idea of using more renewables and moving towards cars that use less and maybe at some point no oil, which we're already starting to see, and then the same, all things being equal, most people are for less pollution versus more pollution. So that those two things by themselves get us not much. but there's something to work with, and there's a dynamic going on that I think is worth discussing and I think is ultimately going to be the thing that gets us where we need to go if we end up getting there. So there's a lot of people that talk about, we can't act, and it's a global problem, which is obviously true, and we can't act unless we act internationally, and the U.S. needs to act itself, and that's obviously true. And some people say we need, to put a price on carbon, which certainly that's one of the many ways we can constrain carbon to send a price signal in the economy. That is definitely one of the ways we can limit carbon. But in the short term, we can have the debates about all of that, or we can just start putting in place carbon-solving solutions, showing people that it works, and building more people, building more stakeholders, to the point where, at a certain point, if we think about every time we have a little win on carbon, every time we put a clean energy measure in place, every time we put an energy saving measure in place, we use that as a way to both secure some little increment of solution, but also to show people that it works, and when it happens, it's actually not only not bad, it's actually pretty awesome. And more and more people are starting to experience that. Again, if you just take your eyes away mostly from Congress, that's where you just don't want to be looking too much, because everywhere else there's room for hope. And, what are the things we need to do? In some ways, it's really pretty simple what we need to do to tackle the climate crisis, right? Or to avoid the worst consequences of it. All of these things are things that are happening in a lot of places, and happening with success, and happening in ways that give people some confidence that the solutions are at hand, and that they are as feasible and desirable as they are necessary. And so, saving energy, most people, all things being equal, think that's a good thing. There's many, many institutional obstacles to that. There's many people who sell fuel who would rather us not save energy, who are putting roadblocks in the way. The same thing to renewables. There's plenty, there's wide public support, solar energy in particular. It was awesome to hear you talk about that. That's a campaign that we've been involved with, and so it's great to see it percolating out all over the state. I was going to mention it if you didn't. But solar is by far the most popular energy source there is. When you poll people blind, like what energy source do you think we should invest in for the future? Across geography, across demography, across ideological spectrum, every single category of person lists solar. It rates highest in those categories. Republican, Democrat, conservative, rural, urban. It ranks higher than any other choice. But you know, the industry is relatively small. It doesn't have good lobbyists in Washington. It only has its workforce is growing. There's 173,000 people in the country working on the solar industry right now. I'll talk about that in a minute. Which is, you know, 25% more than it was the year before, and 25% more than it was the year before that. So it's growing faster than any other sector of the economy, but it's still not a powerful force in the same way that the oil industry or the coal industry or others are that are having an influence, particularly in Congress. Anyway, these are all obvious solutions. I know you guys already know this, and you've probably heard other people talk about this, but the reason that I just brought two slides just to give you a sense of the trajectory that we're on. So wind energy's taken off. We have not, right now, non-large hydro renewables in this country are maybe 5-6%. So that seems kind of depressing. But look how fast it's growing, and look at the rate at which it's growing. Wind is growing. So we, you know, generate 24 times more electricity from wind than we did 14 years ago. Actually, 13 years ago, because that only goes through. So in 13 years, it grew 24 times. And it avoided 132 million metric tons of carbon, which is roughly equivalent to the amount of carbon from 34 power plants. So just look at the rate that wind is growing, and you feel a little better about things. It's depressing that, you know, well, to think of that it's still a tiny fraction of the total, but it really is growing. And then the same thing with solar. Solar's grown 140-fold in the U.S. in the last decade. 140-fold, not 140%, 140-fold. It's 140 times more solar now than there was 10 years ago in this country. And it grew, well, it grew, it tripled in the last, actually, that's wrong, it tripled in the last 2 years. Haste makes waste. And there are more than 173,000 people working in the solar industry. The solar industry grew 10 times faster than the rest of the U.S. economy over the last handful of years. So, again, solar's less than 1% of our current electricity needs, but the rate at which we're growing, if we grew for the next, we just did a report a little while back that looked at the trajectory of solar. If we grow at a quarter of the annual rate that we've grown over the last 3 years on solar, we'd be getting 10% of our power from the sun by 2030. Now, that's not nearly enough. And that's, in many ways, kind of pathetic. That, but the point I want to make in a second is, and we were talking about this earlier with some of the students, just like there's a tipping point we're trying to avoid on climate, in atmospheric chemistry, there's a tipping point that gets created when enough of a critical mass of the economy is on our side, and you know, the solar roof owners, the solar installers, the people in the solar supply chain, the people in the energy efficiency supply chain, the people that realize that, you know, a job making a building more efficient is just as good as a job as building a new inefficient one, as long as, you know, the money is being invested in those things. Once all of that happens, then the political challenges move out of the way, or at least Some of them do. Not to take away from the incredible power of people like the Koch brothers, who and the fossil fuel industry and others, who would stop at nothing to at least slow, if not stop, progress on some of these things. Because of where you sit is where you stand, right? If you're an oil company, there's not much to gain. There's not much to gain in moving away from fossil fuels, other than to diversify into other things. In the first two quarters, I wish I had more recent data, but I didn't. I couldn't find it. In the first two quarters of 2014, two-thirds of the installed capacity in the United States was renewable. More than two-thirds, wind and solar. Unfortunately, you know, the good news was zero was coal. And obviously, we still need to persuade some people that natural gas isn't quite as clean as it sells itself as being. But again, like if you had said this, you know, 10 years ago, that two-thirds of the new energy added to the electricity system was renewable energy, people would be like, no way. So we got to keep that happening, and we got to make less of it, the other stuff. But it just gives you a sense of gives you some reason to be hopeful. But it's not like if we just sit back, it's going to happen without us pushing back against those that are trying to stop it and forcing people to see the progress that we're making as something that should give us the confidence that we can take it to the next level. The key thing is with the and again, we talked a little bit with the students. Wagging our fingers at people about the challenges that we're facing, whether it's the climate challenges we're facing or the other pollution that occurs from our current energy mix, or the folly of fracking or any of the other things, wagging our fingers without some sort of understanding of where they're coming from is not going to work. So you got to start with whatever people's experience is. We know, and I'll go back to that first slide, most people, all things being equal, think renewable energy is kind of cool and think for whatever set of reasons, some people because they believe we got to do whatever it takes to solve the climate crisis. Some people because they don't like oil spills on their beaches. Some people because they're farmers in a rural area that like the tax, the extra revenue wind turbines on their land provides. Different people have different reasons why they like renewables. We just have to identify what those things are and then work with them and use the engagement with them on those issues to help bring it along. We can't afford to get everybody on board with, the science of global warming, and before we take the next step. So we need to be putting the solutions in place as we're engaging people and beginning to have that dialogue that these solutions are at hand and they're ready to go. And they're actually pretty cool when you adopt them. And now that we're talking with each other, let's, you know, talk about this big environmental challenge. Now, that said, we're also not going to win in the end unless enough of the right people and stakeholders have a common understanding of what the problem is and enough of them are seeing that as the reason to do it, right? Because if you're just doing renewable energy because of jobs, and selling it just because it's a jobs thing, or you're doing energy efficiency just because it's an economic thing, without there being some value-laden reason why you're doing it, which is either, you know, the legacy we're leaving our children, or the responsibility to the planet, or our health, or whatever the case may be, we need to be doing that at the same time. But it's got to be a parallel track. Otherwise, we have no chance of winning. You guys will, I'm sure, flag that I missed a whole bunch of obvious solutions. You know, whether it be, you know, first and foremost, you know, the biggest problem we have is we use too much energy to begin with. So I'm sitting here talking about supply, renewables, and wind. You know, one thing we need to be doing is structuring society so that people use less energy, both to get them around and to heat and cool and all the other things they do. So I just used the wind and solar as examples because I thought that they're really good examples of a trajectory that we're on, that if we stay on it, will be transformative. Coupled with significant efforts, you know, if our goal is, and our goal is to get 100 to, you know, power the world or the with 100% clean renewable energy, we can't get to 100% renewable energy without significantly reducing the amount of energy we use as well, right? Because 100% of twice as much energy we use is a lot more renewable energy and a lot harder to get to than 100% of half the energy we use. So we really do need to, and then obviously there's a whole set of other environmental consequences of consumption that beyond just carbon. So I'd love it just to have it be a dialogue. Thoughts or?
What's going on with the whole divestiture issue, that to try to get institutions and pension funds and things like that to divest from fossil fuels?
Well, it's getting a lot of traction. I just think there's a multitude of ways of sort of tackling that beast, and so this is one of them. Ultimately, fossil fuel, I mean, it's an interesting thing because I think most people wouldn't have predicted. I mean, it's not like we won or anything on divestiture, but I mean, the fact that there's actually, I think part of the reason why divestiture is winning is because there is really a business case for it, in addition to a moral case for it. And so I just think that ultimately enough people will recognize the global economic consequences of fossil fuel consumption. And as I said before, maybe I didn't say this, we were talking about this earlier. You know, at some level, right now, you know, maybe 3 to 5% of the economy are fossil fuel stakeholders, truly fossil fuel stakeholders, right? If you're a coal miner, you're a fossil fuel stakeholder. If you own Peabody Coal, you're a fossil fuel stakeholder. If you're, and then there might be people that have shares in those companies, so maybe they're slightly fossil fuel stakeholders. But whereas most of the rest of us are not fossil fuel stakeholders, and in fact, I would argue are clean energy stakeholders. Unfortunately, most of us don't realize that yet. And so our challenge is, through the work that we do to promote these solutions, is to show people this stuff works. It's feasible. It's here. It's now. It's ready to go. We need to do it, but it actually has benefits. Whether we needed to do it or not, it makes sense. And so I think it's the same with the economy. I mean, I think most people are looking at it going, do I really... Yeah, these people are giving me a hard time. I'm getting hammered, but, you know, for being invested in all this bad stuff. But actually, now that I look at it, the downside, there's, you know, the risk is not that great to shift away from fossil. So I think that's that combined, but mostly with some kick-ass organizing that people have done is the reason it's succeeding. So.
I just wanted to comment on that, actually, also. So if you don't know, Williams students did manage to pass a referendum last weekend calling for divestment, and more than half of the faculty and a lot of the staff also signed the letter that they presented to the president. So it's not binding, but the trustees are having it in their face more and more. In addition, Harvard has a week of action the week before the 18th of April, and a big standout in Boston on April 18th, not only for alums and present students, but really for anyone. So So that's really heating up and getting close to them having to make some kind of a decision. Stanford has divested of coal. They're still being pushed a lot by faculty and students for oil. So those things are catching on, and the more that they pass, the more that other institutions are willing to take the gamble. Norway divested recently of tar sands oil and coal and some other things. So it's happening. Also, a bunch of faith communities also have started that process.
Yeah. No, it's we got to attack this on all fronts, and, you know, promoting the solutions and showing people they work, you know, showing, you know, fighting the stuff that we're less excited about or that we hate, depending on what it is, you know, and organizing around that. And both of those things are necessary. And, you know, the people winning on fighting the less desirable stuff, you know, we're not going to win on that unless there's a critical mass of sort of public sentiment that the alternatives to it are viable, right? So you have to have both things, right? You can't be against things, not just because it sort of people don't like people being against things, but one of your arguments for being against something is that there's an alternative that people accept as viable, right? So you need to have both of those things going on.
Do you know of any viable carbon sequestering?
Well, the best way to
you know, Al Gore said plant trees, right?
So. Well, yeah, so there's no question. I mean, yeah, actually, I mean, there's no question that, you know, deforestation or, you know, exacerbates the problem. And afforestation would help. As long as it isn't used as an excuse not to do all the other things, which we also need to do. So more trees is good, because, you know, we're all tree huggers, right? No. But as far as sequestering, I heard I can't remember who said this, but the best way to keep the best way to sequester carbon is to keep it in the ground to begin with, rather than figure out some gadget to, like, capture it and store it forever in a way that won't leak and whatever. So. My personal feeling is we need to actually have some bright minds figuring out how to do that. I just hope those bright minds are figuring out how to capture whatever carbon is left after we do all the things, rather than use the prospect of having sequestration work be a reason to keep burning coal. And that's what was happening for a while. They go, oh, well, we can figure out how to sequester it, so we'll just do the clean coal and whatever, you know, and they never really figured it out. There was a big pilot, the FutureGen project, which we were not excited about, but part of me was saying, you know, if it's a legit pilot to see if it works or not, maybe it's good that it's going forward, because when we can show it doesn't work, we'll be able to say clean coal doesn't work. And turns out they pulled the plug on it because they couldn't figure out how to make it work. So, anyway, I don't know.
So you don't know, there's no real viable...
Well, I mean, there's all sorts of good studies going on that I think are legitimate to figure out how to take it and put it in the deep ocean and what, you know, I mean, there's a bunch of studies. Honestly, it's not something I follow that closely, but it seems like some smart people are looking at it and trying to figure out, you know, how to do it. And as I said, I think we need them doing that. But
are the fossil fuel industries funding those things?
Not really.
No, they don't have a lot of promise.
No, they don't believe it's going to happen. They just wanted people to believe it was happening enough so they could build there was a point where in Ohio, I know they were building some, what'd they call them? CCS ready plants, and they were getting some sort of credit for building a plant that was ready for sequestration when it was available, and they were getting some special pollution credit for doing it. And we were joking, it's sort of like saying, like, yeah, my driveway is like, you know, Tesla ready. You know what I mean? Like, I got the driveway, but I don't have the Tesla. I'm like, you know, like, it's ready for it, I guess, you know. Like, it's like Ferrari ready, right? You know, I get a Ferrari in my driveway. Except for the Ferrari, you know, my driveway is like, could have a Ferrari in it if I had a Ferrari. But otherwise, it's just a driveway.
One of your first slide highlighted carbon emissions of 85% reduction by 2050. So one way that we can reduce carbon emissions is to reduce power. So would you comment on that? Is there a piece in here?
There's not a piece in our plan, but nuclear power, in our opinion, and we actually did a report on this a little while back, saying that nuclear power would actually set back the effort for global warming for a number of reasons. One, it is, by all accounts, unless you look at nuclear industry makeup numbers about its costs, is the most expensive carbon mitigation measure there is. I mean, they have some numbers that kind of like, I mean, the numbers that the nuclear industry talks about for new nukes are like a quarter of what they'll be. Probably less than a quarter of what they'll end up being. They just make up numbers. But, so it's really expensive. Two, there's obviously serious consequences. Two, the risks are quite high of either a catastrophic disaster or ongoing leaking of radioactive material into groundwater or radionuclides into the air. And then there's obviously nobody's figured out a safe place to put the waste other than nowhere. And there's a reason for that, because pretty lethal stuff, and I don't blame anybody for not wanting it anywhere near them. So, and if a disaster happens, like Fukushima, if we actually banked on it, let's say all these other things could be swept away, if a disaster happened, a whole bunch of money would have been spent on that, and at the expense of something else, and a solution would have ground to a halt. I use that term loosely because I don't think it's a solution, but anyway, so that's our opinion on it.
I want to follow up also with natural gas. So natural gas industry will say, oh, this is a bridge fuel, we know it's not great, but it helps it's better than coal. So also leading that comment into thinking about this transition, like we can't flip a switch overnight, right? And make
right.
And everything. So what does the transition look like? And is natural gas, like, is that a legitimate claim by the natural gas industry to say, yeah, that's a part of getting...
Well, right. Even if natural gas is a bridge fuel, we can just use the natural gas. We don't need to build more natural gas infrastructure on the way to using less on the bridge to renewables. Like, right now, we use a lot of natural gas. And so that should be enough to give us the buffer we need while we start using less of it. Instead of some plan that has us use more on our way to using less. Once we start using more, when we go to say, hey, well, let's invest in renewables or efficiency or others, and I can tell you the natural gas industry is not our friend except in the nice ads that they run. But I mean, everywhere else, they are fighting tooth and nail against everything. Renewables in the political arena. Renewables, efficiency, everything else. They'll talk about it, like on the NPR ad about the solar and the wind and whatever, the matching it up. And, you know, but in the real world, they are fighting the policies, that are their competition, right? That promote their competition, which is efficiency renewables. And we were talking about this a little bit earlier, you know, that pipeline, it's coming right through here somewhere, right? Right, the Kinder Morgan pipeline. So I was having a conversation with some state officials, and they were like, well, you know, we have to keep an open mind, they were not talking about Kinder Morgan, but just more gas infrastructure in general, because, you know, energy is expensive and we have to focus on cost. Well, natural gas is about as cheap as it's ever been. What we know from that is that it will only be more expensive, right? So even if you don't care about the environmental consequences and fracking and the fact that methane builds up and, you know, is 20 to 40 times more warming than carbon, even if you ignore all of those things, the idea that we would spend billions of dollars getting access to a fuel whose price will go up, and until we start fracking here, which maybe we would do, but I hope not, it'll be a fast lane for dollars to leave our economy instead of taking that money and investing it in things that keep dollars in our local economy, either because we're tapping into access to free energy that has no fuel cost, like wind and solar, or tap into energy savings, which, people can point to the gap between what somebody like me might say and what there is right now, but I can assure you that once we invest $3-4 billion on a gas pipeline and build out an infrastructure, it's going to be really hard to reverse that, because so much of our economy will then be the same reason it's hard to wean ourselves off of oil right now, because there's a whole infrastructure that is based on oil. Not because people think like oil spills are awesome and fracking is awesome and, you know, all of that. It's because everybody kind of is uneasy about the change that would need to be created and the inertia that leads us to leads the status quo to be the status quo. So to answer your question, I don't really know what the answer is about the actual path. And I think there's plenty of plausible scenarios you can lay out for how you get to these places without, we've done it. Whatever you do will be criticized, but the game is changing so fast. That's why I use that wind and solar example, right? Like, yes, solar is only 1% of our electricity, but it's grown 140-fold in the last 10 years. Wind is only 4 or 5% of our electricity in this country, but it's grown 24-fold in the last 12 years. So if it grows at even a fraction of that rate, it gets to levels that are way beyond anybody's talking about. The EIA, which is the Energy Information Administration, in 2012, they did their 2020 forecast for solar. And this is the body that people rely on to do their kind of, it's the official body that people use to do modeling and that kind of thing for, you know, various scenarios. They did a forecast for the amount of solar that there would be in 2020. In 2012, solar hit that in 2014. So 2 years after. So, and a whole bunch of policy could have and was being made based on the assumption that there would only be this amount of solar by 2020. So we have to, like, our job is to you know, assume there will be game changers, the same way that some of us that are grayer and balder than others of us in this room, remember when nobody had a cell phone and nobody had flat screen TV and I remember when a Prius was totally awesome. You'd say, wow, there's a Prius. Now you're like, a Prius. You know, like, it's boring, right? So, like, stuff is happening so fast in ways that, if we do it right, make any of the assumptions we're making about what's possible just, any of the assumptions that the naysayers are making about what's possible just kind of ridiculous. You know, if you said to me when I was 22, like, your album collection that would have taken up that whole wall can fit on, like, the, you know, head of a pin, I would have left. Or, you know, like, my phone is more powerful than, you know, the first computer I had, right? You know, like, so I think we have to, you know, assume there's game changers, not accept no, see the obstacles that people throw in the way as opportunities, not reasons not to do it. And one analogy I use, and this is maybe not a good one, but I'll use it anyway. So let's say when we decided to use the internal combustion engine to move our vehicles around, society decided to do that. What if when they came up with that idea, somebody said, that would never work? I mean, first of all, do you know how hard it is to distill crude oil and turn it into gasoline? And then we'd have to like go all over the world, and we'd have to punch holes in the ground, and then we'd have to find the places to drill it. Then we'd have to like have oil tankers to ship the stuff, and we'd have to build this whole series of pipelines. We'd have to have refineries near where people, you know, want to buy the gasoline. Then we'd have to have a whole infrastructure to make it easy for retail purchase of gasoline. We can never do that. That'll never work. You know, I mean, and that's, you know, like that. That's what would have happened if somebody said, "Let's not do," you know, "let's not do that." Now, obviously, none of us, I hope, or at least with the benefit of knowing what we know now, wouldn't have advocated for that. We would have gone for something else. But it just gives you a sense of how quickly we can become comfortable and something seems totally normal when, in fact, it took a lot of incredible activity, you know, and technology and logistics to make, you know, a world where everybody was driving in internal combustion engine cars basically everywhere all over the place. And where there weren't roads, they could do it four-wheel driving or whatever. So I think that's the kind of mindset we need to have, except obviously with a little better climate outcome.
I have actually a couple of questions. One is, do you know of any other countries with energy policies that include, that have made it so renewable energy is actually displacing and replacing fossil fuels? And then the other question is, I remember when electric cars were being developed not that long ago, there was an idea where you would buy the car but lease the battery, and there would be battery changing stations around.
Yeah.
And somehow that got nixed. It fell by the wayside. Is that dead or is it still in?
I don't know. There's an Israeli entrepreneur that was doing that. I forget his name. I think that there's going to be a whole bunch of different, you know, approaches to this. And I don't know which one's going to win out. Yeah, I forget the name of it. Well, there's a like the alternative to the AAA. It's called I forget what it's called exactly, but they're trying to be alternative to AAA, which was very, you know, was sort of in the political arena, was doing a lot of work sort of following the lead of the car industry, which now is actually much better than it used to be, because the car industry used to line up with the oil industry on debates about fuel economy and other things. And at a certain point, the car industry realized, we're not going down with your ship. We don't really care what's under the hood. We just want to sell cars, right? You know, so we don't need to be attached at the hip with the oil, you know, like so. But yeah, I don't know what it's going to end up being. But I do think that we're not that far off from people looking at electric cars. I mean, internal combustion engines and like. The way my kids like can't even imagine I typed my papers on a typewriter in college, you know, like they're gonna be like, what, like that? How come that car is making noise and got stuff coming out the tailpipe? I mean, I do think that, you know, that's what it's gonna be like. So, but there's plenty of people trying to stop that from happening, and so and so the momentum is in the right direction, but. There's a lot of people that look like those guys there, trying to stop it.
So is anybody
not that I have anything against guys that look like that automatically, but I saw the coolest thing on Twitter the other day. It was an infograph that I think it was done by the International Energy Agency that looked at the different regions of the world. And the European Union this year and last year, I think, actually it's been displacing. So it had an axis, and then so new it was, and then what the sources were. And in the European Union, everything on this side, which was new stuff, was all renewables, the whole thing. And then everything else they were using less of, including nuclear, gas, coal, whatever.
And,
yeah,
the way their economies
are. It's absolutely 100% because of the policy and an understanding of, you know, and here it's the same thing. Like if you look, I didn't go into this, but we've done a bunch of reports on this in the past. There's two big factors on the growth of renewable energy in this country. One is a federal incentives, which obviously apply to any state. But but the only places where it's really happening, and with solar, it's a great example. I should have shared that. But I think 4 of the top 10 states on solar are states that you wouldn't think of as sunny. So I think it's Massachusetts, New Jersey, North Carolina, and one other one that's like, I can't remember. New York's getting close, but actually Massachusetts has much more solar than New York. So, and same with renewables. You can look at it's the policy, not the availability of the resource. Now, granted, if you're in Colorado or Kansas, there's a lot more wind than there is in this part of the country, and there's certainly places around here you wouldn't want to put wind, just like you wouldn't want to put a gas pipeline. And there's places, right, so it's mostly policy. And then I think there's a few places where it's shifting pretty quickly. China, you know, doing a lot of both. A lot more of the renewables than most parts of the world, but also a lot of the other stuff. But it's starting to pull back on the yucky stuff pretty quickly. Much more quickly than I think people would have imagined, which makes us hopeful. But we still got to get them to push back even more.
What do you think of the utility programs where they offer customers to pay a little bit extra and some of that little bit extra allegedly green energy?
I think that they are fine. I think in a state like Massachusetts, the regulators have been pretty disciplined about ensuring that there isn't double counting, and that if you're actually doing it, it's not just letting the utility charge a premium for something they're already required to do. In some states, it's really problematic, like, you know, where the regulators aren't very good at tracking the credits. So I'm lukewarm about them. I would never discourage somebody from doing that, because I do think any way you send a message is a good one.
Part of my concern is that people can feel good about using more energy.
Well, right. That's why all of those things. But I mean, I think we just have to sort of... Right. I mean, at a certain point, it's like, if you have $10 to spend, do you want to spend by the green, whatever the thing is, or spend $10 on LED light bulbs or whatever? Like, what's your best, you know, highest and best use of your dollar on the planet? You know, probably the energy savings thing is. But and that's why I actually love solar, because I think that people put solar on their roof and it doesn't create it actually doesn't have that impact, because I think once people put solar on the roof, they actually start focusing on their use, and then they start going, how am I going to get it to zero? Well, I could put up another panel, or I could use a little bit less, or I could use it at a different time. It's very direct, and it's kind of like, you know, when people drive a Prius. I have a Prius. And, you know, it's like they talk about the Prius effect, right? It's like you have the information, and you start going, yeah, why the hell was I accelerating on the way to the stop, you know, on the way to the stoplight. So I think it's the same thing with solar. So I do think that solar actually incentivizes people and sort of trains people to actually use less energy in a way that maybe what you're describing doesn't. But, you know, I would never discourage it.
I'm just curious, what happens to solar panels when they're covered with snow?
They don't generate electricity.
Big patch of them down in Adams at the old landfill, which are totally covered with snow and not doing anything.
They'll make it up in the summer, and then I think people should probably pay attention and scrape the snow off them if they can, right? If they're completely covered, they won't be generating any electricity.
I remember, I think it was back in the 1980s, when there was a lot of subsidy for solar hot water. And it seemed like as soon as the subsidies went away, that business just fell off a cliff.
Yeah.
It's the same thing going to happen with wind and solar when those government subsidies
I don't think so, because first of all, the price of solar, well, it's possible, but the price of solar is actually really coming down, and people are developing business models, and that and regulators are beginning to understand that even if solar costs 24 cents a kilowatt hour, that it might be worth 40 cents a kilowatt hour, because where you put it might avoid, you know, might cut the legs out from under peak power and save everybody money, and so it's worth paying you 24 cents a kilowatt hour to put solar on your roof, even though it seems like unfair because somebody else is paying you. You're actually, it's the same way they pay somebody to put up a power line. They're paying you to put the solar on, which is actually going to have benefits to everybody. So people are beginning to be more sophisticated about understanding the value of it beyond, and, you know, in addition, obviously, not pollution. So I just think it, you know, there's a chance it will, but I think at this point, the industry is so ingrained, it's not as fledgling as it was in the 80s. And so I just think they're going to figure out how to make it work, and it's, but there's plenty of people trying to kill it, you know. I mean, Arizona, one of the utilities in Arizona, a co-op, just adopted a thing charging every solar user $50 a month if they use solar.
For the net metering.
Yeah. $50 a month. I mean, like, some people don't even use $50 a month worth of electricity, right? There's like, so like, you know, it basically kills solar in there. It basically kills solar in their whole territory.
A cost that the solar people are not paying with net metering? Is it the people who...
Well, that's why I'm saying...
The solar end up paying for the...
Well, right. No, that's why I'm saying... That's why I'm saying...
Is it fair to have some cost associated...
Probably. But not until you figure out what the value of solar is. And that's why I was saying, it might be worth it for me to pay you 24 cents a kilowatt hour for your solar, because you're using solar on a hot sunny day when everybody's cranking their air conditioner. The fact that you're using solar is actually saving people more money than I'm giving you. And so it's actually an investment in the system to give you money to do solar. So you can argue, well, somebody else didn't have it, it's not fair. But even that person that's subsidizing your solar, they're subsidizing the power line, they're subsidizing the gas that we're buying, they're subsidizing the industrial rates that the utility gave somebody that so that they would stay there and do the job. So there's cross subsidies that go all over the utility thing. And so the question is, before we start putting in these charges, utilities want us to look at it and say, solar costs 24 cents a kilowatt hour. You're a freeloader at the expense of some poor working family or whatever, right? That's what they want the narrative to be. And so you're basically getting 24 cents at the expense of everybody else. What we want the narrative to be is, let's figure out the value of solar that it provides to the grid, the real value, not the cost, the value. Then you subtract the cost, figure out the net, and yes, it's true that there's a point at which, if you want to be connected to the grid, you should be able to, there should be some, you know, something you'd be willing to pay to...
Not just the grid, but, you know, if you get enough solar out there, you're going to need large-scale energy storage.
Right.
And the solar people are paying for that. It's going to be a ratepayer cost.
Exactly.
You're right. A ratepayer.
But no, I totally agree with you. I'm just saying, like, they want to have that debate. The utilities want to have that debate before we have the discussion about the value of solar, and then just focus on the cost, and then go, okay, well, so let us just internalize that cost, and then we'll pass it back off to you without looking at the overall thing. So.
We've come to the end of our time for tonight. Let's thank Rob for coming.